No word yet this morning on whether any Americans were hurt or killed in Iran's missile strike on military bases in Iraq housing U.S. troops overnight. Today is Wednesday, January 8th. This is WBUR's Morning Edition. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. Coming up, Iran says the missile strike was retaliation for last week's killing of an Iranian general. President Trump tweeted out, quote, all is well, but gave no specifics. The president is expected to make a statement later this morning. We'll bring it to you live when it occurs. Also this hour, how Iran is factoring into the presidential campaign. Here's Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard in New Hampshire.
This president and his cabinet have decided to push us into war with Iran.
And this hour, a Ukrainian airliner crashes in Iran. All 176 on board were killed. None were Americans. Forecast turning sunny today in the 30s today. It's 7:01. Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump says he'll make a statement this morning following Iranian attacks late yesterday on two U.S. missile bases in Iraq. There are no reports of injuries or deaths, and U.S. officials haven't released information about damage. Iran's Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei spoke after the Iranian strikes. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports from Tehran.
This was the Supreme Leader's first public speech since the death of Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian general killed by a U.S. drone strike in Iraq Friday. Khamenei celebrated the retaliatory missile attacks, which he called a slap in the face.
What is important is that the corrupt presence of the United States in this region should come to an end.
Khamenei gave his remarks in Qom, a city that is Iran's religious center. He was there to mark the anniversary of protests that sparked the Islamic Revolution. The Ayatollah eulogized Soleimani, praising him for his bravery, his religious faith, and especially for his work guiding Iran-backed militant groups throughout the Middle East, including Hezbollah in Lebanon. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Tehran.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he has enough Republican votes to start President Trump's impeachment trial without Democrat support. Both sides have bickered for weeks over whether to call witnesses. NPR's Kelsey Snell reports this suggests McConnell is ready to move forward with the trial rules.
It signals that he is confident that he has the votes not only to get this trial started, but likely to move forward with things as he wants them to work. So he wants to establish these rules and kind of set up a framework for what this trial looks like, in part because he never really wanted to agree to these witnesses. Democrats said that they actually believe that he never wanted to agree to call in new witnesses, though he says it'll be something they'll address further along the line. It shows that he believes he has Republicans all together.
NPR's Kelsey Snell. Puerto Rico is getting federal aid after a series of earthquakes in recent days. NPR's Giles Snyder reports President Trump has signed an emergency declaration for the U.S. territory.
The emergency declaration makes federal emergency aid available and authorizes the Federal Emergency Management Agency to coordinate disaster relief efforts. The president signed the declaration the same day that Puerto Rico was hit by the strongest earthquake to jolt the island in more than a century. The quake had a magnitude of 6.4 and was one of a series that has shaken the island since December 28th. It was followed by a number of aftershocks. At least one person was killed. Several others were injured. Much of the territory remains without power. President Trump has a fraught relationship with Puerto Rico and its political leaders. His administration was accused of being slow to respond to the devastation left behind by Hurricanes Irma and Maria in 2017. Giles Snyder, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. Members of the state's all-Democratic congressional delegation are urging the U.S. to be cautious in response to Iran's missile attacks on military bases in Iraq last night. Speaking on CNN, Congressman and former Marine Seth Moulton said the need for restraint cannot be overstated.
Take the opportunity that Iran has presented us to not escalate this any further. It's not in our strategic interest in the Middle East. It's not in our strategic interest globally to get bogged down in a war with Iran.
Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley says the Trump administration is, quote, goading the U.S. into a reckless war. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is calling for a $500 million increase in affordable housing funding in the city in the next 5 years. He's also asking state lawmakers to ensure the MBTA is more reliable. Those were two of the goals laid out in Walsh's State of the City address last night. WBUR's Simone Rios reports.
Walsh's address focused on big issues, housing, transportation, education, and he praised Boston as one of the most progressive cities in the country.
Together, we've made Boston the safest, healthiest, most dynamic, productive, and inclusive city it's ever been.
But Shigun Idowu of the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts says there's too much flowery language from the mayor and too little improvement for the poor.
Not to take away positive things said, we know the city is doing some good work, but there's a lot more that we need to be doing. We've got a lot of hurting people in communities of color, particularly black communities.
Walsh pledged to raise $500 million to combat the affordable housing shortage. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Simone Rios.
A New Hampshire judge has ordered jury selection to start by November in the trial of a West Springfield man accused in a crash that killed seven people in New Hampshire last year. Prosecutors say Vladimir Zukovsky was driving under the influence. He's pleaded not guilty. He was driving with a commercial license that should have been suspended by the Massachusetts Registry over violations in other states. The Newton City Council tonight wades into the fight over a 22-acre redevelopment project in Newton Upper Falls. The city approved the massive housing and business project last year, but opponents say it's too big and say they've collected enough signatures for a voter referendum to reverse approval. The city council could vote to schedule a referendum or rescind approval for the project. This is WBUR. It's 7:06.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by East Meets West Catering and East Meets West at the Exchange, catering for all life's occasions inspired by you, eastmeetswestcatering.com, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio.
Sports: the Bruins crushed the Predators in Nashville last night in a 6-2 win. Six different Bruins scored. The Bruins are back at the Garden tomorrow night to play Winnipeg. Tonight at the Garden, Celtics face the San Antonio Spurs. Forecast: there are a few scattered snow showers remaining this morning, but turning sunny today, and it gets to the upper 30s. Clear and cold tonight in the teens. Sunny in the 20s tomorrow, sunny in the 40s Friday, then warm on Saturday. Clouds and showers, but 60 Saturday. Showers in the 50s on Sunday. In Boston now, we're at 32 degrees. It's 26 degrees in Worcester, 31 in Salem, and 32 degrees in New Bedford at 7:07.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm David Green in Culver City, California. Well, Iran's retaliation for the killing of a top commander came early on Wednesday morning. More than a dozen ballistic missiles targeted two military bases in Iraq that house U.S. and coalition forces. The Pentagon has not released any reports on casualties or damages at this point. Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, called these strikes an act of, quote, self-defense. This attack comes less than a week after a U.S. drone strike killed Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani in Iraq. The Islamic Republic had vowed to avenge Soleimani's death. Now, our colleague Mary Louise Kelly, who hosts NPR's All Things Considered, has been reporting in Tehran, and she joins us this morning. Hi, Mary Louise.
Good morning, David.
So what does all of this feel like from Tehran? How are people reacting to these Iranian missile strikes on U.S. forces?
So this is all over the news here, as you would imagine. I've been flipping through Iranian TV this morning, and they have all got graphics up and maps showing where these bases are in Iraq. People here are trying to process what exactly happened overnight, what exactly it means. I went downstairs for breakfast at our hotel here in central Tehran, and the waiter who was fixing me an omelet and coffee said, did you see what happened overnight? And I have to confess, it took me a second to think, what exactly is he referring to? Is he
talking
about
the missile
strikes?
Happened overnight?
Which thing? We've also, in the last 24 hours, had this deadly stampede, this awful thing that killed dozens of people in the hometown of Soleimani as his body was being carried through the streets for burial. We had this plane crash this morning, a Ukrainian jetliner that went down just moments after takeoff at Tehran's airport. So it has been quite the extraordinary last 24 hours of news here. I will say on the missile strikes specifically, there is a sense of, okay, this has happened. Iran has taken a step to retaliate for the killing of Qasem Soleimani. Now Iranians are watching to see what the reaction from the United States will be, what the White House will say, and what the United States might do next in response.
So is that definitely where we are? I mean, Iran has done its retaliatory move and everyone's waiting for the United States now? Or is it less clear that this is the retaliation that Iran had planned? Could there be more?
Right. Well, that is the question. Is this it, or might there be more coming from Iran? State news media in the last several hours has characterized the missile attacks as the start of promised revenge. The official ISNA media outlet is carrying a statement from Iran's Revolutionary Guards hardliners, which reads, and I'll quote, "We are warning the U.S. that if they take any further action, they will receive a harsher response." We also, for the first time since Soleimani's killing, heard the big public speech today from the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He gave a speech in the holy city of Qom in Iran. He called the missile attacks carried out by Iran a slap in the face of the Americans. Let me let you hear a little bit of this, David.
When it comes to confrontation, military actions of this kind are not enough. What is important is the presence, that the corrupt presence of the United States in this region should come to an end.
You can hear the cheering there in response to those remarks.
People like what he was saying.
Exactly. Khamenei is suggesting this is one act, these missiles, one act of Iran's response, but not the fulfillment of Iran's goal, which, as you heard there, is he wants the U.S. to get out of the Middle East entirely.
Well, and I mean, that's the supreme leader. You actually had a chance to talk to Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, yesterday. What did you take from that conversation in terms of what Iran may do to fulfill that goal?
Right, because this is always a question in Iran. There are many parts of the government, and what you hear from the supreme leader and what you hear from the elected leaders and what you hear from other factions of the government, the parliament, et cetera, you're always trying to piece together who is saying what and how does it all fit together. When I interviewed Javad Zarif yesterday, we sat down, we had 10 minutes together. He would not tell me what was coming. He did not telegraph these missiles attack in Iraq, would give me no specifics. Since then, and this is worth mentioning, he has tweeted, "We do not seek escalation or war. We will defend ourselves against any aggression." So a hint there from Iran's foreign ministry, at least, that maybe they are looking for a way to de-escalate.
It's NPR's Mary Louise Kelly, who hosts All Things Considered and has been on a reporting trip in Tehran for us this morning. Thanks, Mary Louise.
You're welcome, David.
Okay, so as you heard, a lot of uncertainty about where this all may go. What we can say right now is that these attacks on U.S. forces and these broader tensions have all raised some questions about the U.S. troop presence in Iraq. Will the United States leave? Well, just before the attacks from Iran, U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper said unequivocally no.
Our policy has not changed. We are in Iraq, and we are there to support Iraqi forces and the Iraqi government become a strong, independent, and prosperous country.
But does Iraq want the U.S. to stay? Well, after a U.S. drone strike killed that top Iranian commander on Iraqi soil, Iraq's parliament voted to expel foreign forces. So what exactly would that mean? Well, the 5,000 American troops in Iraq are there fighting ISIS, though not really at this moment. The fight against ISIS is on hold as the U.S. prepares for this potential conflict with Iran. And let's talk through the implications of that with someone who has played a central role fighting the Islamic State. Brett McGurk has served three presidents. Until last year, he was the U.S. special envoy for countering ISIS. Thanks for being here this morning.
Thanks, David.
What is your understanding at this point? I mean, is the fight against ISIS on hold? Could it actually be over?
Well, first, I think we've got to think through the Iranian calculations. And Mary Louise's report there was really quite telling. I think, number one, Khamenei and the leadership in Tehran, first and foremost, focus on regime survival. So they're going to try to use this to really consolidate their grip inside the country, crack down on protests, which has been going on. That's their number one focus. Second, what he apparently said today, Khamenei, that they want Americans out of the region, just brings us into Iraq. I think that is their objective, to politically get us out of Iraq. The proxy groups that operate in Iraq, I think we should not be so naive to think that they are simply going to stand down. So I think there remains a significant risk to our presence there.
Well, let's follow this through. I mean, you have Iran's official policy getting the United States out of the region, out of Iraq. You now have Iraq's parliament voting to expel foreign forces. To what extent is this just show, and to what extent could we really be moving to a moment where we see the United States getting out completely?
Well, yeah, I was in Iraq in a real crisis in the summer of 2014 when we negotiated an arrangement to return, and we came back in a much different way than in the Iraq war days, with a big coalition. And we have an exchange of diplomatic notes with the Iraqis, and we did put a clause in that, I remember. There's about a kind of a one-year termination agreement. So that's why my thought over the last few days is just everybody needs to calm down here. Let's not try to make irreversible strategic decisions in the midst of a crisis with passions at their height. There is some time, because if we do make the decision to leave Iraq, or if we're forced to leave Iraq, I think the consequences would be quite serious. I think the extent of Iranian domination in southern Iraq, the vacuum that would open up for ISIS to fill. And don't forget the Russians. I think they would fill in right behind us, because it's not just us in Iraq. It's a coalition with NATO and about 20 Western partners. So we need to try to maintain that presence as we prepare for Iran's next move.
Well, how crucial is the United States specifically in the fight against ISIS? I mean, you mentioned a country like Russia filling the void. Russia obviously has an incentive to wipe out ISIS. So, I mean, if we reached a point where the United States was leaving, I mean, do you foresee ISIS operating freely in the country, or do you see them still, you know, facing quite an enemy?
Well, it wasn't very long ago you used to see 50, 60 car bombs, suicide bombs a month in Iraq. And ISIS wants to reconstitute those networks. And as they do, that's how they carve out safe space to then begin to target the West again. We are extremely, extremely effective. Since 2014, we have trained Iraqi security forces and their counterterrorism service forces. They're some of the most battle-tested, most effective forces in the region. They're aligned very closely with us. We're helping them with operations to make sure that these networks cannot reconstitute. We're doing it at a very low risk to ourselves. We're not fighting. We're not taking casualties. We're not spending much money. It's a very, I think, a smart, sustainable presence. And without us, I think it'd be very difficult to keep the pressure on those networks. And Russia really cannot take our place effectively.
Can I just return to this latest attack from Iran? I mean, as you were listening to Mary Louise, she was seeing some signals that Iran might want to de-escalate, you know, if the United States does not respond with force. Do you see the potential for a de-escalation here, especially given that it looks like, at least in terms of early reports, that there were no casualties?
Well, the fact that we're talking about after a missile strike of 12 ballistic missiles from Iran targeting Americans on Iraqi bases in Iraq as a potential moment to de-escalate just shows what a heightened, extraordinary crisis this has been. And I think the risk now of a signature attack like that, in which they take credit for it, perhaps that has now been diminished. But remember, the Iranian attacks since May in the Gulf against Gulf shipping, the Aramco attack in Saudi Arabia, they have not taken credit for those. These are done by cutouts and proxies. And I do not think we should be so optimistic that the risk of that has significantly diminished. I think there will be another move here. But I do think it is a moment to just calm things down, buy some time. And I hope that's the tone the president will set later this morning.
Well, all eyes will be on that and the possible next move from the United States and where this goes from here. Brett McGurk, he was the U.S. Special Envoy for Countering ISIS. Thanks so much for your time, as always.
David, thank you.
This is NPR News.
Join us at WBUR City Space for Curated Cuisine, a conversation with Douglas Williams, chef and owner of Mita in Boston's South End. Details at wbur.org/cityspace.
Just ahead on WBUR's Morning Edition, will the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump soon move forward, now that Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell says he has the votes to start without the support of any Democrats? This is WBUR.
We are funded by you, our listeners, and by Lexus Broadway in Boston, with the new production of Fiddler on the Roof from the Tony Award-winning director of South Pacific and The King and I, and with songs including Tradition, Matchmaker, Matchmaker, and Sunrise, Sunset.
Fiddler on the Roof plays the Emerson Colonial Theater February 25th through March 8th. Tickets at lexisbroadwayinboston.com. And Xfinity, with an app that lets you pause your Wi-Fi for device-free family time. More at xfinity.com.
Now the weather. After the overnight light snow, we got sunshine today. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
A storm system pulls away here this morning. It returns the sunshine by the afternoon. It becomes breezy, temperatures in the upper 30s, maybe near 40. Tonight we're down in the teens, and with the wind, it feels in the single digits. Cold for Thursday. Temperatures 25 to 30, one of the colder days we've had so far this winter, which hasn't been very cold. On Friday, partly sunny, mid to upper 40s. A blend of clouds and sunshine will continue here. Early Saturday, there might be a couple of showers with more clouds in the afternoon, but wow, is it mild, low to mid 60s. And Sunday, a few showers, maybe a thunderstorm. Temperatures will be falling out of the 50s.
In Boston now, 31 degrees at 720.
Iran's foreign minister insists his country does not want nuclear weapons.
If we wanted to build a nuclear bomb, we would have done it a long time ago.
I'm Ari Shapiro. As Iran breaks limits set in the 2015 nuclear deal, we look at what's known about the country's nuclear capabilities this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on 90.9, and when you ask your smart speaker to play WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR. And from Visit St. Pete Clearwater along Florida's Gulf Coast, offering a variety of museums, including St. Pete's Dalí Museum, Chihuly Collection, and the Museum of Fine Arts. More at visitstpeteclearwater.com. The George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, an online resource dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students with information and strategies about what works in K-12 education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And Charles Schwab. Schwab believes a modern approach to wealth management starts with asking questions. Charles Schwab, own your tomorrow. Learn more at schwab.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Good morning. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he has the votes to start the impeachment trial without hashing out the terms with Democrats. McConnell confirmed yesterday he is abandoning attempts to reach an agreement with Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
We're going to get started in exactly the same way that 100 senators agreed to 20 years ago. What's good for President Clinton is good for President Trump.
The announcement comes after weeks of disagreement about how to hold the Senate impeachment trial of Donald Trump, specifically whether to call any new witnesses. NPR's congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell is in the studio with us this morning. Hi, Kelsey.
Good morning.
So what are the consequences of McConnell's announcement?
Well, it signals that he is confident that he has the votes not only to get this trial started, but likely to move forward with things as he wants them to work. So he wants to establish these rules and kind of set up a framework for what this trial looks like, in part because he never really wanted to agree to these witnesses. Democrats said that they actually believe that he never wanted to agree to call in new witnesses. Though he says it'll be something they'll address further along the line, it shows that he believes he has Republicans all together.
That means we're not going to see John Bolton, who said that he would come.
It's not totally clear that we won't see John Bolton, but it looks like that means that witnesses will come down to individual questions later on once the trial has begun. And when it's an individual question, it's a question of a 51-vote question in the Senate. So 51 senators have to agree to bring a witness in. And that means that Democrats, if they want to bring somebody in, have to convince 4 Republicans to join their side. And that is a big, difficult ask.
We've got tape from Minority Leader Chuck Schumer yesterday who was talking about this.
They're afraid to say yes because they know Donald Trump will be furious at them.
Right. And that is what Democrats keep saying, is they now believe that it is much more difficult for them to get witnesses. That's why they wanted an agreement up front. And that's part of why they were so dismayed when McConnell said that this was not, you know, part of his plan.
So what's the timeline? When can we see the trial start?
It's not totally clear because it's still up to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to send the articles of impeachment over to the Senate. And she has not made clear that that is happening anytime soon. So this could stretch out for several more weeks before we even really know when things will begin.
Huh. All right. We have to talk about this. Today is also the day top intelligence and national security officials are going to brief members of Congress about the drone strike that killed Iran's top commander, Qasem Soleimani.
Do we have any sense of what that's going to look like?
Well, it's a really large venue for these briefers to be coming in, to be talking to huge groups of members of Congress, all of the House members on one side and all of the senators on the other. So it's not really a great venue for really detailed conversations. And that's actually something that members on both sides have complained about over the years. So it may not be a very detailed conversation, very in-depth investigation into what has happened.
They may not hear the intelligence that they're using as justification for
this. That's part of why there have been requests for additional briefings and more follow-up so that Congress can stay on top of what has happened and what may be coming in the future.
So overnight, Iran retaliated more than a dozen missile attacks on these two bases that house U.S. troops in Iraq. So does President Trump at this point have to get approval from Congress in order to now up the ante, do anything in response?
Technically, Trump is supposed to inform and consult with Congress at every possible moment. But that hasn't happened so far. And then, you know, it really is not often that Congress reasserts their power to ask for that. So we are expecting the House to vote on a war powers resolution to kind of reassert some of those powers, but we don't know when, and Democrats are still talking about that.
Okay. NPR's congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're also following news in India today. Trade unions are on strike and protests are underway across the country. Demonstrations erupted, we should remember, nearly a month ago. This was in opposition to a citizenship law that critics say discriminates against Muslims. But in recent weeks, they have morphed into much wider anti-government protests. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from Mumbai.
At the gateway of India, an iconic marble arch overlooking Mumbai's port, protesters waved Indian flags and sang a Hindi version of a 19th century anti-fascist hymn. In most of India's major cities, it's been nearly a month of rallies like this. Most of them have been in opposition to India's new citizenship law, which grants amnesty to undocumented migrants from three neighboring countries, except if they're Muslim. Critics accuse Prime Minister Narendra Modi's right-wing government of discriminating against Muslims and of trying to turn this secular democracy into a Hindu nation.
We cannot have citizenship on the basis of religion. It just goes against the very secular fiber of our country.
Protester Priyanshi Bahadur is from a Hindu family, like about 80% of Indians. But she fears Indian Muslims, who number nearly 200 million people, are becoming second-class citizens.
It is a problem for me because I am empathetic, I care about other people, and India is not a Hindu state because it's a secular state.
The protesters' list of grievances has expanded in recent weeks to the government's crackdown in Kashmir, slowing economic growth and police brutality. The latest protests are in response to violence last Sunday at an elite university campus in New Delhi. Masked thugs armed with metal rods stormed dormitories at Jawaharlal Nehru University. They beat students, faculty, and security guards. The college has long been a bastion of left-wing politics, and it had hosted lots of anti-government protests. It's unclear who the attackers were. Students blame Hindu nationalists loyal to Modi. But Modi's party denies that, blaming left-wing groups instead. Most of those who've taken to the streets in recent weeks are from the left-wing urban elite, people who never voted for Modi in the first place. They're worried the secularism enshrined in India's constitution is under threat. But protester Ganesh Kanate acknowledges that's not really a concern for most Indians.
They are caring about their own welfare. My house, my car, my wife. It's a little difficult to pull him out of the economic comfort. That's a challenge.
India's middle class is booming. Modi won re-election last spring in a landslide, in part by appealing to Hindu pride. These may be the biggest protests in decades, but unless his Hindu nationalist base turns against him, Modi's job is secure. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Mumbai.
This is NPR News.
This is WBUR. Coming up on Morning Edition with President Trump due to speak later this morning, we're waiting word from the White House on possible retaliation to the Iranian missile attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq. Plus, how the tension with Iran has quickly become part of the focus of Democrats in the presidential campaign. Maybe you've got a great car for commuting, weekend drives, or just doing errands. But if you're ready for a new one, join other WBUR listeners who've donated a car to WBUR. It helps us bring you the news. Learn more at WBUR.org/cars, and thanks.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by DCU, Digital Federal Credit Union. Get paid up to 2 days sooner with direct deposit and a DCU free checking account. Visit DCU.org. And Huntington Theater Company with We All Fall Down, a hilarious new play about a family trying to throw a Seder for the first time. The only problem? They've never had one before. Written by Huntington Playwriting Fellow and Somerville resident Lila Rose Kaplan. Can this family come together, or will an age-old tradition tear them apart? Starts Friday. HuntingtonTheater.org.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Later this morning, President Trump is to make a statement about Iran's ballistic missile attack in Iraq. More than a dozen missiles were fired at two bases housing U.S. troops. No American casualties are reported. It was Tehran's response to last week's U.S. drone strike in Iraq that killed Iran's top military general. NPR's Windsor Johnston says lawmakers on Capitol Hill will hear more today about the president's decision to launch that drone strike.
Lawmakers will be briefed by key White House advisors, including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Secretary of Defense Mark Esper. The meeting comes as congressional Democrats continue to question Trump's order to carry out the strike and whether it was legally justified. Some top members of Congress have complained they were kept in the dark about Trump's decision to order the strike that killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani.
The FAA is banning U.S. airliners from operating over much of the Middle East amid heightened tensions with Iran. Here's NPR's Giles Snyder.
The Federal Aviation Administration is telling U.S. airlines that they are banned for the time being from flying over Iran, Iraq, the Persian Gulf, and the Gulf of Oman. In issuing the airspace ban, the FAA said there is the potential for miscalculation or misidentification amid heightened military activities and increased political tensions.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. More reaction this morning to last night's missile attacks by Iran on military bases in Iraq that house U.S. troops. Senator Ed Markey says the country must not get drawn into war with Iran and says President Trump must go to Congress for approval on the use of military force. Congressman Richard Neal, chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, calls it a serious escalation of tensions between the U.S. and Iran, and is calling for restraint on both sides. Supporters of the Equal Rights Amendment have filed a lawsuit in Boston federal court to ensure the ERA is added to the U.S. Constitution if it wins approval from enough states. Congress approved it back in the 1970s, but with a ratification deadline of 1982. However, it fell short of the 38 states required. With lawmakers in Virginia expected to approve the ERA this year, making it the 38th state, plaintiff's attorney Wendy Murphy is challenging that 1982 deadline.
Equality is an important right that, of course, you want to put in the Constitution. And, you don't want to arbitrarily deny women equality because the clock ran out.
The ERA would require equal protection under the law, regardless of sex. North Shore Medical Center today unveils a new sex assault treatment program in Salem. It'll allow emergency department staff to work in real time with off-site experts to collect forensic evidence and tend to a patient's needs. Sabrina Federico is Executive Director of Emergency Services for North Shore.
Providing emotional support to the victims is important because we ultimately want to empower the patient. Our mission is to provide sexual assault survivors and their loved ones with the support, resource, and freedom to determine the course of their own healing.
The new program is in partnership with the State Department of Public Health. Sports: the Bruins snapped their three-game losing streak last night with a 6-2 win over the Predators in Nashville. The Bruins will be at the Garden tomorrow night to skate with the Winnipeg Jets. Tonight at the Garden, Celtics play the San Antonio Spurs. Forecast: little lingering overnight snow continuing this morning for a while, but but it should pretty quickly move out now, turning sunny breezy today, highs in the upper 30s. The night clear and cold. Lows will be down to the teens tonight with wind chills in the single digits. Tomorrow sunny, only in the 20s. Friday partly sunny in the 40s. Saturday clouds, some showers, but warm, right around 60 on Saturday. Then Sunday, showers and in the 50s. In Boston now, 31 degrees, 28 degrees in Framingham, 30 in Lawrence, and 31 degrees in Fall River at 735.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Margulies Ferrucci, serving life science firms with integrated design to help advance creativity and scientific breakthroughs. mparchitectsboston.com. C3.ai. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. And Fidelity Wealth Management, where advisors work with their clients to develop flexible investment strategies that can evolve as their needs change. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green in Culver City, California.
And I'm Rachel Martin in Washington, D.C. After Iran's attack on U.S. bases in Iraq last night, President Trump tweeted, quote, "All is well." He went on to say, quote, "Assessment of casualties and damages taking place now. So far, so good." The Defense Department said Iran launched more than a dozen ballistic missiles against at least two bases in Iraq that house American and coalition troops. No casualties have been reported thus far. The strikes are retaliation for the U.S. drone strike that killed Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani. We're awaiting more from President Trump, who said that he will make a statement this morning. Meanwhile, NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe is with us. Hi, Aisha.
Good morning.
So we saw that tweet from President Trump. Anything more from the White House about what has happened?
Not really. So there was that tweet and about saying that all things are or all is well. And in that tweet, he also stressed that the U.S. has the most powerful and well-equipped military in the world. So this wasn't kind of upbeat message from the White House after this serious attack. One key thing is it didn't include any explicit threat for Iran at that point. A White House press secretary, Stephanie Grisham, did say that the president was briefed on what happened and that he was closely monitoring the situation while consulting with his national security team.
So U.S. officials, the Trump administration was well aware of Iran's promise to retaliate, to strike back against Soleimani's killing. Do we know what kind of precautions were taken?
Well, so we know that the Defense Secretary Mike Esper and Mike Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they were at the White House yesterday. The Pentagon said that these bases had been on high alert and that appropriate measures had been taken to safeguard personnel. So the U.S. had been warning Iran not to retaliate, but the military had been preparing for attacks.
Right. The congressional leadership was briefed last night.
So they were briefed this time. Republican leader Kevin McCarthy received a call from the president last night. Vice President Pence called and informed House Speaker Pelosi. This comes after the administration faced criticism for not consulting with Congress before moving ahead with the strike on Soleimani. So Republican Senator Marco Rubio, he tweeted that a full assessment is underway to determine an appropriate response to Iran. But even with all of that, many lawmakers were still just trying to gather information last night on what was happening. You had some Democrats who were still questioning the president's decisions ahead of these strikes by the Iranians. Congresswoman Barbara Lee said that what the administration has done has created a tragic spiral of violence.
So obviously everyone's going to be reading in between the lines of the president's words this morning when he's expected to give this statement as to whether or not this is over or if the U.S. is going to respond again, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question. Like, Trump has been saying that any retaliation by Iran will provoke a stronger response and possibly a disproportionate response. But obviously, other officials in the administration have been saying they want de-escalation and not war. If officials can confirm that there aren't any casualties, that could provide a way out of the escalation for both countries, despite all of this kind of heated rhetoric.
White House reporter Aisha Roscoe, thank you.
Thank you.
This is WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes. The escalating conflict and crisis with Iran has become a central focus of the presidential campaign. Voters are expressing concern, and the Democratic candidates are talking about it. Among them, Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, who hosted a town hall meeting in Northfield, New Hampshire last night. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks was there and has our story this morning.
As Gabbard began her talk in a restored Railroad Depot building, the mood was somber. News of the Iranian missile attack on bases that house Americans in Iraq was just breaking.
We are in a state of war. Again.
Last night's attack was retaliation for the assassination of Iranian General Qassem Soleimani. As a member of Congress and a National Guard major who has served two tours of duty in Iraq, Gabbard has made this the central issue of her long-shot presidential bid, opposition to what she calls America's endless wars. She says now Trump is starting another one.
Unilaterally acting to commit an act of war without any constitutionally mandated declaration of war from Congress, this president and his cabinet have decided to push us into war with Iran.
As president, she says she'd bring U.S. troops home from Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, and focus on problems at home. Gabbard has been polling in the low single digits in New Hampshire. Even so, about 100 people came out to hear her last night, and many of them were impressed.
She's the candidate I've been waiting for.
Sue Roosh from Bristol, New Hampshire, agrees with Gabbard about bringing American troops home and says Trump was wrong to assassinate Soleimani.
It's only going to make things worse. Things are going to escalate. He's not saving our country. The man was a bad man that they took down, but you need to have diplomacy.
Chris Langlois from Winchester, Massachusetts, agrees and says President Trump acted recklessly.
I personally don't think it was a good move on his part. I thought this was just a little too aggressive. It's a very important issue to me. I have a lot of friends who are serving right now, and kind of the thought of them having to, this impending conflict with Iran is kind of concerning to me.
But there was also support for Trump's decision to order the assassination.
I am very grateful that a bad guy is dead. You know, whether it was right or wrong, he's a bad guy not here anymore, and that makes me feel good.
This is John Griffin from Norfolk, Massachusetts.
You're not concerned that it might pull us into a war?
I don't like war. I'm not for it for anybody at all, but one less bad guy alive right now.
The Trump administration argues it assassinated Soleimani to preempt a planned attack on U.S. interests, but it has yet to offer evidence to back that up. Gabbard says the assassination will further destabilize a troubled region and endanger America.
Now, this is something that I've been warning about for months, that if we continue to escalate these tensions between the United States and Iran, it would lead to a war with Iran that will prove far more costly and devastating to our country and to people across the region than anything that we've seen with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
The other Democratic candidates have also criticized the president's decision. Elizabeth Warren called it reckless. Bernie Sanders says it brings us closer to another disastrous war. And here's former Vice President Joe Biden speaking in New York City yesterday.
The haphazard decision-making process that led up to it, the failure to consult with our allies or Congress, and the reckless disregard for the consequences that would surely follow was, in my view, dangerously incompetent.
Up until now, the presidential primary campaign has focused almost exclusively on domestic issues, health care, immigration, gun violence. But now the Democrats are talking about the importance of foreign policy experience, war, and peace. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks in Tilton, New Hampshire.
This is WBUR. Coming up on Morning Edition, the state of emergency in Puerto Rico following the powerful earthquake there, which killed at least one person and caused severe damage. Now the weather. WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein says the sun returns.
We'll see the morning clouds give way to sunshine today. Temperature 35 to 40. Winds get gusty. For tonight, it's blustery. We're down to the teens. On Thursday, sunshine, cold, only near 30. Friday, partly sunny skies, 45 to 50. It's breezy. On Saturday, really mild. We're in the low, perhaps middle 60s, maybe a record. It's breezy with a few showers. On Sunday, mild in the morning and then turning chillier in the afternoon and at night.
In Boston now, 31 degrees. Subscribe to the WBUR Today newsletter to get Dave's forecast every weekday in your inbox.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Curriculum Associates, local creator of iReady, designed to empower teachers and drive achievement for 8 million children nationwide. CurriculumAssociates.com. Indeed, with its skills tests, built for employers who want to see a deeper sense of the person behind the resume. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And Deloitte, committed to helping clients see the possible in digital transformation and achieve it. To transform work, business, and communities. At Deloitte.com/US/only see possible.
Now, Bostonomics Business, home sales are rising. The Massachusetts Association of Realtors says more than 2,900 homes were put under agreement last month, 5% more than last December. But Association President Kurt Thompson says it remains a seller's market because of the shortage of homes for sale.
Buyers want to buy. Interest rates are absolutely incredible, but because of that lack of inventory, they're just not finding enough homes in the market to be able to satisfy that need.
The median price for a single-family home put under agreement last month was $415,000, up more than 10% from last December. Newton-based telecom firm New England Fiber is being purchased by an investment and real estate firm in Los Angeles. The CBRE Group says buying New England Fiber will help its clients adopt new 5G cell technologies. The price of the deal was not made public. Massachusetts is home to three of the best places to eat in the entire country, according to a new Top 100 review by Yelp. Carmelina's in Boston's North End comes in at number 49, Preller Restaurant in Marlborough ranks 76th, and JJ's Cafe in Brockton place 78. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Peabody Essex Museum. There's a whole new world to explore at the Peabody Essex Museum. A new wing, new exhibitions, a new experience. PEM.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. In Puerto Rico, a state of emergency has been declared after a 6.4 magnitude earthquake struck in the early hours of yesterday morning. People across the island woke up to find crumbled walls, destroyed homes, also downed power lines. This was the latest and most powerful of a series of quakes to shake the region. Now, Puerto Rico has, of course, lived through hurricanes, but the governor, Wanda Vasquez, put this in perspective. She said when it comes to the earthquake, the island had not seen this kind of emergency in more than a century. Luis Treyes is reporting on this in San Juan. He's a producer with the NPR podcast Radio Ambulante and joins me now. Hi, Luis.
Hi.
So first, tell me what it felt like when this earthquake hit.
Yeah, so I was actually awake around 4:30 in the morning yesterday when my own building starting to shake pretty violently. I hadn't lived through something like that before, not in Puerto Rico, and it was a big scare.
I mean, and what kind of damage did it cause as you started to see what impact this had?
Well, I'm in San Juan, in the capital city, in the northeast of the island, so there wasn't major damage reported here, thankfully. Most of the damage was concentrated along the southern coast of the island. And one thing you have to understand, David, is that this earthquake comes at the heels of daily tremors that have been occurring in Puerto Rico for over a week and a half now. So that adds to the insecurity that a lot of people here feel. As you know, we're accustomed to hurricanes, but earthquakes are kind of a new thing for most Puerto Ricans.
And tell me about where the worst damage was, what part of the island, and what you've been learning about how bad it was.
Yes. So a lot of the damage was concentrated around the town of Guayanilla, Ponce, and Yauco, three towns in the southern coast of the island. Local authorities confirmed the death of a 73-year-old man in the town of Ponce, and other towns like Guayanilla were especially hard hit. Several houses and buildings crumbled, at least one public school plummeted to the ground, and some area hospitals had to be evacuated. And we've been experiencing a prolonged blackout after the earthquake, which has left most of the island residents without electricity.
I mean, you mentioned that going through an earthquake is different from a hurricane, but I imagine for a lot of people on the island, there have to be flashbacks to what you went through in Hurricane Maria in 2017.
Oh, yeah. For many, the situation here brings an unwelcome flashback to the devastation caused by Hurricane Maria in 2017. I mean, that experience left an estimated 3,000 deaths and a power outage that lasted from 3 to 5 months for most residents here in the island, and also a lingering sense that both the local government and federal authorities were not prepared to handle that disaster.
Do people feel like their government and, both at the local and federal level are prepared this time?
I don't think so. I think there's a sense that Puerto Rico's infrastructure took a really hard hit with Hurricane Maria, and that there's a sense that it's not ready to handle a major catastrophe right now.
Luis Treyes is a producer for the NPR podcast Radio Ambulante, reporting from San Juan. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, David.
This is NPR News.
A number of customers tell us that they've heard us on WBUR.
Nick Darbaloff, VP of Commercial Business for Sunbug Solar, a WBUR underwriter.
Most important is that they are hearing our name in conjunction with WBUR, a very highly respected, high-integrity source of news, and that association, in our mind, is extremely valuable.
For more information about underwriting WBUR, call 617-353-8451.
This is WBUR, ahead on Morning Edition, a tenants advocate on Boston Mayor Marty Walsh's $500 million affordable housing plan. The mayor outlined it last night in his State of the City address. Forecast careful on the roads this morning as some are still slippery after the overnight light snow, but it is coming to an end and we get sunshine today. Upper 30s today. Clear and cold tonight down to the teens. Sunny tomorrow and Friday in the 20s tomorrow and the 40s on Friday. In Boston now, 31 degrees. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, celebrating the living legacy of artists with a new contemporary art exhibition in the Company of Artists, now through January 20th. Mass General Hospital, the number one research hospital in America, developing innovative treatments for complex conditions to get you back to the life you love. Mass General, revolutionizing care. And Plymouth Rock Assurance, offering customers a ride home through their Get Home Safe program. Learn more at PlymouthRock.com.
This is WBUR. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is outlining plans he says will dramatically increase the amount of money available for affordable housing in the city. He detailed the measures last night in his State of the City address at Symphony Hall.
Rents and home prices are stabilizing, but they're still too high for too many people. There's much more work to be done. So tonight, I'm announcing an unprecedented investment, $500 million over 5 years to create thousands of homes all across our city, affordable to a range of incomes from our most vulnerable to the middle class.
The money, the $500 million, would come from an increased investment by the city, a proposal to sell the city-owned Lafayette Garage downtown, and a request for the state legislature to allow the city to charge a fee of up to 2% on real estate sales of over $2 million in the city. Joining us for reaction to the mayor's housing plans this morning is Mike Leyba. He's director with City Life Vita Urbana, a community organization that promotes tenants' rights and prevents housing displacement. He joins us via Skype. Good morning, Mike, and thanks for speaking to WBUR's Morning Edition.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks for having me.
So big picture here, what elements of the mayor's housing plans do you like?
You know, I like the fact that He is committed to investing $500 million in affordable housing. That's a step in the right direction, you know, to the extent to which it's directed at strategies that help low and moderate income renters in the city and homeowners stay in their homes and keep their hard-earned money in their pockets. That's a good thing.
But what's it lacking?
One of the things that's missing from the mayor's speech is any talk about evictions or displacement, policies that limit rent gouging or that increase tenant protections are just as important as investment in new affordable housing.
So, Mike, give me a specific of what you think the mayor needed to say in that regard.
So in order to maximize the benefit of this type of investment, we have to pair it with policy. Any kind of policy that limits rent gouging or that increases tenant protections are important. So things that are currently pending at the State House, like Mike Connolly has a local options bill, which would allow the city of Boston and cities throughout the Commonwealth to revisit or reenact rent control if that's something that they want to do. Something like right to counsel, which actually helps people stay in their homes as opposed to building new affordable housing for them to move into, which is, you know, many years down the line, or something like tenant right to purchase. These are all policy battles that are happening in the State House. And if we want to have a mayor who's really focused at anti-displacement, we need them to be able to weigh in on all these things.
Beyond keeping people in their homes, allowing people to access housing for the first time is also important, according to activists. The mayor's plan calls for creating units for new homeowners and supporting 1,000 people with down payment assistance and low-interest mortgages. What's your reaction to that part of the proposal?
I think homeownership in a city like Boston is simply out of reach for many people. You know, it's a very expensive market. It's a hot market. And for better or worse, there will be a lot of renters in this city. I think that we really need to focus on who needs help most urgently, and that's the city's renters.
Another part of the mayor's plans is to launch a city-funded rental voucher program designed to help families experiencing homelessness who aren't eligible for state emergency aid, those who've been chronically homeless and low-income elderly and disabled households. Do you think that this type of program can help people stay in their homes?
I think that providing rental vouchers is a good thing. I think it will help some people stay in their homes, but I do think that doing it in an unregulated and really expensive real estate market is kind of a band-aid approach. It's a temporary benefit at best.
So in the big picture, Mike Leyba, is the mayor's program just a good start or a really big push?
So I think the big picture for the mayor's program is just that it's incomplete. In addition to increased investment, we really need tenant protections. And we can't really talk about displacement in Boston without talking about rent control. There's a statewide effort to repeal the statewide ban on rent control. There's a hearing next Tuesday. We invite the mayor to come testify if he's really committed to anti-displacement in the city of Boston.
Mike Leyba, director with City Life Vita Urbana, thanks a lot for speaking to WBUR's Morning Edition.
Thanks for having me.
A little bit of light snow we got overnight should melt today. There are still some spots this morning getting some snow flurries, but they should quickly move out, turning sunny, upper 30s today. Tonight, clear and very cold. It'll be down to the teens, but wind chills in the single digits tonight. Tomorrow, sunny and not beyond the 20s. Friday, partly sunny and in the 40s. In Boston now, 31 degrees. Join us tomorrow night at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline for Facing Civil Rights, a film about racism in 1960s Brookline. A panel discussion moderated by Radio Boston's Paris Alston will follow the film. Details at WBUR.org/events. Stay with us. Today's top stories are coming up. The time is 1 minute before 8.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Linguistica 360, an online streaming service to learn Spanish, French, Italian, and German through the news, lessons, and original series. Linguistica360.com. And Vertex, fueled by the needs of patients, families, and healthcare providers, Vertex invests in science to strike at the core of serious diseases. VRTX.com.
When I was a kid, everyone was trying to lose weight.
A salad, please.
And it clearly wasn't working.
Please tell me my thighs don't look that bad.
Later on, I seriously tried dieting and I gained 15 pounds. Food, we need to talk. That's the name of WBUR's new podcast. I'm Una Jada.
And I'm Dr. Eddie Phillips. We're going to help you get to a happier and healthier place with food. Food, we need to talk. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at City Space, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
No word yet this morning from the White House or Pentagon on possible retaliation following Iran's missile attack on U.S. bases in Iraq. Today is Wednesday, January 8th. This is WBUR's Morning Edition. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. Coming up, what next after the missile attack? In a tweet, all President Trump said is all is well. He's expected to speak later this morning. WBUR will have it live. Here's Defense Secretary Mark Esper from yesterday.
We've increased our force protection postures across the region and will continue to reposition and bolster our forces as necessary.
Also this hour, the Ukrainian jetliner crash in Iran overnight, all on board killed. And this hour is focus on housing. In Boston, Mayor Marty Walsh's State of the City address last night.
We believe in a Boston where housing is more than a commodity, it's our community.
Turning sunny today after the overnight snow in the 30s today. It's 8:01. Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump says he'll make a statement later today. This follows Iran's missile attacks against two U.S. bases in Iraq. There are no reports of injuries or deaths. Following the attacks, the international community is responding. International airlines have suspended flights, and some nations are evacuating citizens. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Beirut.
From capitals around the world, one message: restraint. In the meantime, the Philippines government ordered the evacuation of its citizens from Iraq, sending the Coast Guard to pick them up. Many Filipinos work for U.S. facilities and private companies. Singapore Airlines joined some regional carriers in suspending flights to Baghdad. The U.S. Aviation Authority banned all U.S. carriers from flying over Iran, Iraq, and the Gulf of Oman. Iran's retaliation against the death of Qasem Soleimani was highly symbolic. Missiles launched at 1:30 a.m., the same time as a drone strike that killed the commander, and Iranian officials tweeted pictures of the Iranian flag, matching the U.S. president's tweet after he ordered the drone strike. Deborah Amos, NPR News, Beirut.
The American Cancer Society says that cancer deaths in the United States have seen their biggest year-to-year decline ever. NPR's Richard Harris reports this is mostly due to a drop in deaths from lung cancer.
Death rates from cancer have been declining gradually in the United States for years, but the drop between 2016 and 2017 is the biggest yet, the Cancer Society says. The rate dropped more than 2% from one year to the next. That's largely because a lot of people have stopped smoking over the past two decades, and that means fewer people are getting lung cancer. The Cancer Society says improved treatments are also contributing to the trend. And while the death rate from cancer is falling, the actual number of cancer cases continues to rise. That's because cancer mainly affects older people, and the U.S. has more old people than ever. Richard Harris, NPR News.
The death toll in Australia's wildfires has now risen to 26 people. As the fires continue to burn, authorities are asking people to stop sending food and clothing to the affected areas. NPR's Jason Bobian has more from Nowra, New South Wales, Australia.
The Premier of the state of Victoria, Daniel Andrews, says people's generosity during this ongoing fire crisis has been wonderful. But he says unsolicited truckloads of donations have become an added burden on relief officials.
We don't need any more trucks on our roads. We don't have the warehouse capacity, the people or the time to sort through. I know it all comes from a place of kindness.
He thanks those who've already given and says he doesn't want to sound harsh, but the need right now isn't for bags of used clothes or canned food. Andrews says what will really make a difference are cash donations to reputable charities that will help fire victims rebuild their lives. Jason Bobian, NPR News, Nowra, New South Wales.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. Massachusetts Congresswoman Lori Trahan and Congressman Jim McGovern are among the House lawmakers demanding specific answers from the White House on its strategy for dealing with Iran. A letter sent this morning from nearly three dozen House members followed last night's missile attacks by Iran on military bases in Iraq. Other members, including Congresswoman Catherine Clark and Congressman Joe Kennedy, are urging restraint in response. In other news this morning, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is urging state lawmakers to do more to fix the region's transportation system. In his State of the City address last night, Walsh said more reliable public transit is needed.
So I urge my partners on Beacon Hill, as you take up transportation financing, be bold. Do more than repair a system of the past. Invest in the future of our Commonwealth. And if you can't move this forward, let us lead.
Walsh says cities and towns should be allowed to hold elections to win voter approval for transportation projects and ways to pay for them. A case involving the recording of police officers in public goes before a three-judge federal court appeals panel in Boston today. WBUR's Deborah Becker has the story.
The key question involves the state's wiretap law, which prohibits secretly recording anyone. A lower court and a federal judge have ruled that surreptitiously recording law enforcement in public is protected by the Constitution, but the Suffolk County DA appealed. Matt Siegel with the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts says the ability to covertly record police is necessary.
Recording openly can sometimes be dangerous for the recorder, and recording openly might not get the full flavor of what police officers are doing.
Suffolk DA Rachel Rollins says her office is concerned that private third parties could be unknowingly taped with police. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker.
Smoking will soon be banned in and around all playgrounds in Lowell. The Lowell City Council approved the ban last night. Anyone caught lighting up within 50 feet of a playground could be fined $200 for a first offense and $300 for a second offense. The Lowell Sun reports the ban includes all forms of tobacco, marijuana, and vaping products. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by GEICO, protecting people and their vehicles for over 75 years. GEICO is proud to offer car insurance and more to Massachusetts drivers, too. Additional information at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO. And iDrive, maker of Remote PC, providing remote access to computers anywhere for remote assistance and featuring Remote PC Vision, an augmented reality support tool. Learn more at remotepc.com.
Sports muscle on the ice last night. Six different players scored for the Bruins last night in the team's 6-2 win over the Predators in Nashville. Bruins back in action tomorrow night when they host the Winnipeg Jets. Tonight at the Garden, Celtics play the San Antonio Spurs. Forecast turning sunny today. The few scattered snow showers are moving out. Highs today in the upper 30s. Tonight clear and cold, lows down to the teens. Sunny in the 20s tomorrow. Sunny in the 40s on Friday. Then the weekend. It'll be warm on Saturday. Clouds and showers, but 60 Saturday. Showers in the 50s on Sunday. In Boston now, 32 degrees, 29 in Needham, 30 degrees in Brockton, and 28 degrees in Gloucester at 8:07.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green in Culver City, California.
And I'm Rachel Martin in Washington, D.C. The Trump administration knew it was coming. Iran promised vengeance for the U.S. killing of its top general, Qasem Soleimani. Here's what Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, told NPR yesterday.
The United States has committed a grave error. A grave error. And it will pay for that grave error.
Iran's payback came in the form of missile strikes. More than a dozen ballistic missiles hit two military bases in Iraq that house American troops. NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman starts off our coverage this hour. Tom, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
What can you tell us about these bases? How many U.S. troops are stationed there?
Well, we don't have the exact number at these bases. The one is Al-Asad Air Base west of Baghdad. It's a very large base. You're talking at least hundreds of troops. And then the other base was in Erbil in the northern part of Iraq. Again, no estimate of exactly how many troops they tend to keep that pretty quiet, but probably hundreds of troops as well. And what we know is that at least a dozen ballistic missiles were fired from Iran. Most of these missiles hit at Al-Asad Air Base. They're saying roughly 10 or so. No sense of any casualties yet. As a matter of fact, President Trump, about 4 hours after these pre-dawn attacks, tweeted that all is well. So initial indications are no American or Iraqi casualties. But again, we don't have any firm information yet. And the same is true at Erbil, at a base up there, although we don't have the name of that base. Mm-hmm. No indications of either American or coalition or Iraqi casualties at this point. And the president said we're still trying to assess the damage at both locations.
Although it's interesting, the missiles originated from Iran, right?
That's right.
And that sends a particular message.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there were indications there would, I mean, Iran said they would strike back in retaliation for the killing of Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force.
But they didn't come from an exterior base somewhere. This was meant to be a very clear, decisive message.
Oh, absolutely. And they called this Operation Mader Soleimani. Clearly, the Americans were braced for attacks in Iraq because overall there were 5,000 American forces there. There was a sense that some of these bases would be hit. I think the indication was, or the expectation was, that proxy forces, the Quds forces or the Iranian-backed militias, would fire mortars or rockets from inside Iraq right. at these bases. So it is remarkable that they did come from Iran.
Just to express their regional reach. What are you hearing, Tom, just in the halls of the Pentagon? Are you hearing about an overall strategy?
No, that's been a problem all along. What is the strategy? What is the way ahead with Iran? Defense Secretary Mark Esper told reporters he hopes that Iran will de-escalate, and that was a day or two before these ballistic missile attacks. So the big question now is, if there are no American casualties, no Iraqi or coalition casualties, will the U.S. respond some way to this? The president has said there were 52 targets in Iran that they could strike. But frankly, they may just decide if there are no casualties, maybe they won't strike back. But we'll have a better sense today. The president is expected to go out sometime this morning, and there'll be some sort of Pentagon briefing as well. We'll get a better sense of the way ahead.
Okay, NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman following that angle. Thank you.
You're welcome, Rachel.
So as we mentioned, both of these strikes hit U.S. military bases in Iraq. That country was, of course, the location for the U.S. drone strike that happened last week, killing Iran's top military general, and the whole thing led to the current escalation. So the question for NPR's Jane Arraf in Baghdad, how is Iraq responding to a conflict playing out on its soil? Jane joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So did Iran get a heads up? Did Iraq get a heads up? Did Iran tell them that this attack was coming against U.S. forces, these bases?
Well, kind of, sort of. The prime minister's office just released a statement saying that they received a call from the Iranians, a call, mind you, saying that they were about to strike U.S. military targets in Iraq. And the prime minister's office says at the same time, the U.S. military called to say their bases, two bases, one in Anbar al-Assad and another base in Erbil province, the Harir Air Base, were being rocketed. So they gave them a heads up and made sure to stress they were targeting the American military, although there are a lot of Iraqi military there as well. And the interesting thing was no casualties reported, which is very unusual with a strike of this size. The prime minister is reaching out to try to contain this. He says he wants it not to slide into all-out war because Iraq would be the first to suffer.
Hmm. I mean, that's got to be vexing for this country, right? I mean, this is a U.S.-Iran conflict playing out on an Iraqi battlefield, essentially. What are you hearing from Iraqis about that?
This is basically the worst fear of officials and people in the streets. People are extremely worried because this has been simmering for a long time, and the worry has been that it will erupt into something much worse between Iran and the U.S. Now, we have to remember as well that Iran and Iraq fought an 8-year war in the 1980s with a million people dead. And it's a much different Iraq now. There's much more Iranian influence here in the government. But the dynamic is still very fluid, and the country is very, very polarized. Some parties here are calling for a summit with regional leaders to try to diffuse the attention. And some politicians who welcomed U.S. troops leaving say this increases their belief that the troops do have to leave so that Iraq doesn't become more of a target.
Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman and I were just talking about the fact that these missiles originated from Iran. This was not an attack that came out of Iranian-backed militias in Iraq. But those are still there, right? These militias. How big a threat are they?
They are a very big threat, perhaps the biggest threat next to Iran, because the problem is they're not all fully under the control of the Iranian government or the Iranian regime, and they're certainly not under the control of Iraqi security forces, even though they're supposed to be. So after this strike, one of the big Iran-backed militias, Asab Ahl al-Haq, League of the Righteous, pledged further retaliation. They said that strike was in revenge for Qasem Soleimani. The ones that they and others will launch will be in revenge for a senior Iraqi leader, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, who was also killed in the U.S. drone strike.
All right, NPR's Jane Arraf reporting from Baghdad. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
Okay, so just hours after these missile strikes, another major story developed in Iran. A passenger plane crashed shortly after takeoff at Tehran's International Airport. This aircraft, a Boeing 737 operated by Ukraine International Airlines, it disappeared from radar just minutes into its flight to Kiev. A video that's been widely circulating on social media seems to show this plane on fire before it exploded into this huge fireball. Now, we should say NPR has not confirmed that video's authenticity. We do know all the passengers, 176 passengers and crew on board the plane, did not survive. Journalist Charles Maines has been following this story from Moscow. And Charles, what is the latest we know from this crash site?
Well, as you know, David, it's 176 dead, although we've seen these varying numbers through the morning from various different news agencies. But the point here is there are no survivors. That's for certain. Iranian rescue workers are on the ground. They're attempting to recover remains that are scattered among the wreckage. That's no easy task. About the crash itself, we know that Iranian emergency ministry officials say this was due to technical error. They say the engine burned up. And they say they found the black boxes. So I imagine we'll find out more. You mentioned this witness video, this purported witness. This video. Yeah. Indeed, it does seem to show a plane on fire and losing altitude before hitting the ground in this massive explosion, if in fact that's what it was.
Do we know about the victims, where they're from?
Well, right. So we've been hearing from Ukraine's foreign minister. He posted a tweet this morning that said of the 176 people on board, just a few, in fact, were from Ukraine, the vast majority from Iran, perhaps not so surprising, but also from Canada, the rest from Afghanistan, Great Britain and Europe. But just to be clear, no Americans on board.
Just to be really clear, Charles, I mean, given the missile attacks from Iran, given all the news we've been covering in this region, is there any suggestion here that this was anything other than, as you said, a technical error, something like that led to what seems like an accident?
Right. You know, Iran says it's not, and the Ukrainians seem to be backing them up. The Ukrainian embassy in Tehran said it ruled out terrorism as a cause of the crash and that preliminary information showed the crash was indeed caused by engine failure. But of course, this does come after these missiles were launched by Iran towards the American bases in Iraq. Interesting to see that Jordanian state media issued had a tweet actually that came out this morning saying that it wasn't, the plane had in fact been brought down by a missile. There's not a lot to back that up, but as it happens, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is in Jordan right now on an official visit. He's been posting on Facebook all morning and first offering condolences and then saying that he'd ordered a criminal investigation into the crash and that all theories were still on the table.
So we might be learning more. I just also want to clarify something else for our listeners, Charles. This plane that crashed was a Boeing 737, not though a 737 MAX, which is the type of aircraft that has had so many problems we've been reporting on those two other crashes.
That's right. This is a Boeing 737-800NG, to be specific about the model. It's not, of course, the MAX, which has had so much trouble of late. We do know this plane was about 3.5 years old. The airline issued a statement noting they bought the aircraft direct from Boeing in 2016, and its last scheduled maintenance actually took place just 2 days ago on January 6th. So, of course, a lot of questions as to what happened, if indeed this is a tech issue, as we're being told.
And what happens now in terms of an investigation?
Well, you know, first of all, the airline isn't taking any chances. They've canceled any flights to Tehran just in case. Meanwhile, the Ukrainians have launched their criminal investigation. Iran's Civil Aviation Authority has their investigation. Presumably, they'll work together. One big question, what role Boeing might play in all this, given the current hostilities between the U.S. and Iran?
Journalist Charles Maines covering this story from Moscow. Charles, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
This is WBUR. Ahead on Morning Edition, presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders on the increasing tension between the U.S. and Iran following the missile attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq last night by Iran. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Capterra for helping people find the right software for their business. Users can see software rankings, read reviews, and compare options side by side. Learn more at Capterra.com/NPR. Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, and a video conference room solution in one platform featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing. Account registration and more at Zoom.us. And Progressive Insurance, offering its Home Quote Explorer, so shoppers can evaluate options in one place when buying home insurance. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at Progressive.com.
Now the weather. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
We'll see the sunshine return later on this morning and early afternoon, 35 to 40 with a gusty westerly wind. For tonight, the winds continue. It's cold. We're down in the teens. Wind chills by morning will be in the single numbers. On Thursday, sunshine, only 25 to 30, less wind. Friday, we're back to the mid to upper 40s. The winds flip around to the southwest this time. And Saturday, the real story is the mild air, low to mid 60s. Couple of showers around the area. Sunday, a few more showers, maybe a thunderstorm. Temperatures in the 50s, falling late in the day.
In Boston now, 32 degrees at 820.
Funding for WBUR weather reports comes from GEICO, offering the GEICO mobile app, which stores ID cards and enables bill pay and claim reports directly from your cell phone. Learn more at geico.com. Other supporters include Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health, the largest yoga-based retreat in North America. Find your center at Kripalu, Kripalu.org. And Montessori Schools of Massachusetts for a 21st century education. Visit a Montessori preschool, elementary, or middle school to see what 21st century learning looks like.
Iran's foreign minister insists his country does not want nuclear weapons.
If we wanted to build a nuclear bomb, we would have done it a long time ago.
I'm Ari Shapiro. As Iran breaks limits set in the 2015 nuclear deal, we look at what's known about the country's nuclear capabilities this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on 90.9, and when you ask your smart speaker to play WBUR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. They said retaliation was coming, and it did. Overnight, Iran launched more than a dozen ballistic missiles targeting two U.S. military bases in Iraq. The attack comes less than a week after a U.S. drone strike killed Iran's top military commander, Qasem Soleimani. Democratic primary contenders have been weighing in on the tension between the U.S. and Iran, including Senator Bernie Sanders. I spoke with him yesterday before the Iranian attack on the U.S. bases in Iraq, and I asked him if the, quote, imminent attack that the Trump administration had cited was justification for killing Soleimani.
No, and I haven't seen any of the evidence being brought forth which justifies their claim. The bottom line is that the war in Iraq was the worst foreign policy blunder in the modern history of America. And I fear very, very much that Trump is moving us in exactly the same direction as I saw in 2002, 2003, and getting us into a war with Iran. And if that happens, what we will see is the loss of more American lives, the loss of lives around the world, trillions more spent in another endless war. And as a United States senator, I will do everything I can to prevent that from happening.
It is true, though, that Iran has not exactly been acting in its best behavior. It's been exhibiting a lot of dangerous behaviors. What would you do differently if you were president to rein in Iran?
Well, you know, Iran is the leadership of Iran are not nice guys, and you're quite right. They have been involved in a lot of ugly activities. But so has the leadership in North Korea, which has killed hundreds of thousands of their own people. So has Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, who killed an American journalist and is a thug and a murderer. When you go around assassinating a government official, you unleash international anarchy. And all the rules are gone, and anybody can do anything that they want. And I get very, very nervous about that.
Would you, Senator, as president, keep any U.S. troops in Iraq?
Here you have a situation where the United States has lost 4,500 troops. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have died. We have spent trillions of dollars, and now we're being booted out of the country we came to so-called liberate. And then you have Trump the other day saying, if they throw us out, we're going to have trillions of dollars of sanctions on them. And the next day you have somebody in the State Department or in the Pentagon saying, oh, we're leaving because we respect the sovereignty of the people of Iraq. They want us out, we're going. And then the next day you have somebody say, oh, that was a mistake, we're staying. So, you know, this is the chaos that takes place in an administration that acts impulsively, that has no plans for the future.
But if it was on you, what would be your plans? Would you keep U.S. troops in Iraq?
No, we would not be in Iraq right now. We would have been out before. But
You can't look backwards. You have to deal with the present facts.
Well, I'm not the president. Trump is the president right now, and he is causing all of this chaos. I think that endless wars and the so-called war on terrorism has by and large been a disaster. It's created more instability around the world, incredible loss of life, and the expenditure of trillions of dollars. So what you need to do is end endless wars by withdrawing American troops in an appropriate, well-thought-out way, not through a tweet, not by getting booted out, not by a phone call with somebody. You do it working with your allies and working with, in fact, the people of Iraq to make the withdrawal as consistent and as positive as possible.
Would you keep a force on the ground, a special operations force, to maintain the pressure against ISIS?
What I worry about right now is Trump continues to destroy our relationships all over the world. Iraq is in the process of booting American troops out. So how open they will be to continued having American involvement in there remains to be seen.
But I guess what I'm trying to clarify is, would you be okay with pulling America back from the Middle East, Iraq in particular, and allowing Iran to then fill that void?
Well, Iran now already has enormous influence in Iraq. And I think the time is now to withdraw American troops.
So you would be okay with them having
Trump,
even more influence?
Hold it. But unlike Trump, I believe in diplomacy. I believe in negotiations. The goal is to bring countries together to try to address international conflict without war. And Trump is cutting our ties with major countries all over the world, making it more difficult for us to do that.
I'm interested in a big picture answer from you about how you do see America's role in the world. Should America be active in foreign conflicts in order to promote its own interests, in order to promote the interests of its allies?
Well, the United States is the wealthiest, most powerful nation on Earth. We should use our wealth and our resources through carrots and sticks to bring countries together, to end the kind of terrible conflicts that we are seeing all over the world, to strengthen international organizations where people can sit down and argue rather than shoot guns or drop bombs against each other. Now, I'm not a pacifist. There are times when war may be necessary. But I believe, as somebody who is a young person, opposed the Vietnam War, which was such a disaster for my generation, as somebody who helped lead the effort against the war in Iraq, which was such a disaster for our younger people, that I will do everything I can to resolve international conflict through diplomacy, through negotiations and not through the continuation of endless wars. Enough is enough.
Senator Bernie Sanders, thank you so much for talking with us.
Rachel, thank you very much for the opportunity.
This is NPR News.
This is WBUR. Ahead on Morning Edition, Iran's military strength and its arsenal of weapons. We examine them following Iran's missile attack on U.S. targets in Iraq overnight amid all the chatter about war. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the BSO. Works by Trailblazers, Mozart, Tchaikovsky, and a world premiere by Chichon Chi-Sun Lee, January 16th to 18th. Tickets at bso.org. Vertex. Fueled by the needs of patients, families, and healthcare providers, Vertex invests in science to strike at the core of serious diseases. VRTX.com. And Curriculum Associates, creators of iReady, a program designed to empower teachers and drive achievement for 8 million children nationwide. CurriculumAssociates.com.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump is expected to have more to say next hour about Iran's missile attack on two bases in Iraq housing U.S. forces. No American casualties were reported. NPR's Tom Bowman says the attack came days after a U.S. drone strike near the Baghdad airport killed Iran's top military general.
The president has said there were 52 targets in Iran that they could strike, but they may just decide if there are no casualties, maybe they won't strike back.
The FAA is now banning U.S. airliners from airspace over Iran, Iraq, and areas of the Persian Gulf. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he has enough Republican votes to begin President Trump's impeachment trial without the support of Democratic lawmakers. NPR's Kelsey Snell says Democrats continue calling for new witnesses to testify, including former National Security Advisor John Bolton.
It signals that he is confident that he has the votes not only to get this trial started, but likely to move forward with things as he wants them to work. So he wants to establish these rules and kind of set up a framework for what this trial looks like, in part because Democrats said that they actually believe that he never wanted to agree to call in new witnesses, though he says it'll be something they'll address further along the line. It shows that he believes he has Republicans all together.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. Members of the state's congressional delegation are calling for de-escalation after Iran fired missiles on military bases housing U.S. troops in Iraq. Congresswoman Catherine Clark says it's a dangerous situation that does not look like security for Americans. Congressman Joe Kennedy says the missile attacks are the fault of President Trump and that American people do not want war with Iran. In Boston, the public school system is on track to get a $100 million boost to its budget. WBUR's Kerry Young reports Boston Mayor Marty Walsh promised the funding in his State of the City address last night.
The new funding will be phased in over the next 3 years, with $33 million on the docket for fiscal year 2021. District officials say 39 underperforming schools will be targeted first. Superintendent Brenda Caselius hopes to spend the money on a few key focus areas.
So improving our academics, supporting families, getting mental health supports out, and then ensuring that teachers have what they need to be successful.
City officials say they hope to maintain the increased spending levels in perpetuity. Funding increases from the state are expected to ease the burden on the city budget eventually through recent changes to the state's school funding formula. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Carrie Young.
The FBI is reportedly investigating the Oak Bluffs Fire Department and its EMS service. The Vineyard Gazette reports the inquiry began last spring and is focused on the billing practices of the town's ambulance service. Neither town officials nor the FBI are commenting. Sports: the Bruins snapped their three-game losing streak last night with a 6-2 win over the Predators in Nashville. Bruins host the Winnipeg Jets tomorrow at the Garden. Celtics at the Garden tonight with the San Antonio Spurs. Forecast turning sunny and breezy today. Highs in the upper 30s. Clear and cold tonight. Lows down to the teens. Wind chills in the single digits tonight. Tomorrow, sunny, not beyond the 20s. Friday, partly sunny in the 40s. The weekend, clouds and showers, but warm on Saturday, right around 60 degrees. Sunday, showers and in the 50s. In Boston now, 32 degrees. It's 26 degrees in Worcester. The time is 8:34.
Funding for WBUR weather reports comes from GEICO, offering the GEICO mobile app, which stores ID cards and enables bill pay and claim reports directly from your cell phone. Learn more at geico.com. Other supporters include Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil. Metamucil Premium Blend contains plant-based psyllium fiber, is made with natural flavors and colors, and is sweetened with stevia leaf extract. Learn more at metamucil.com. And iDrive, providing cloud backup, full system backup, and on-site iDrive appliance to protect PCs, Macs, and servers from data loss due to crashes and ransomware at iDrive.com/NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm David Green in Culver City, California. And let's listen to some sound from Iran's state media. That, according to state media, is the sound of ballistic missiles being launched from inside Iran. Iran fired more than a dozen missiles at two military bases in Iraq that are used by U.S. forces. These ballistic missiles are among the most sophisticated weapons held by Iran. So what do we know about them? Let's ask NPR's Jeff Brumfield, who covers science and security for us. Hi there, Jeff.
Good morning.
So what exactly do we know at this point about these weapons that were used in these strikes on these bases in Iraq?
Well, as you said, based on the footage and reports out of Iran, these appear to be ballistic missiles. So these are basically missiles that shoot very high up into the air and then come down very fast and very hard on their targets. These are similar to the Scud missiles that Iraq used in the first Gulf War, but the difference is that these are much more sophisticated weapons. They have precision guidance. They are apparently capable of carrying decoys that can fool missile defenses. And generally speaking, they're believed to be pretty accurate.
And this is significant to underscore here, right? I mean, there was some speculation that this retaliation from Iran could come from, like, militias linked to them from inside Iraq. These are weapons that were fired from inside Iran into Iraq, which covers a certain distance.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we're talking hundreds of miles, and these are a totally different class of weapons. So the sorts of rocket attacks that happened at U.S. bases prior to this had been small rockets. The warheads were maybe a few kilograms. These are weapons with warheads that are hundreds of kilograms. These are much, much larger missiles.
So sometimes it's hard to figure out exactly who is in charge in Iran. You have the supreme leader, obviously. You have the president. You have the Revolutionary Guard, where Soleimani was a general. And he, of course, is the one who was killed by that U.S. drone strike. Do we know who specifically fired these missiles in this retaliation?
Yes, we do. I mean, these missiles would have had to have come from Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and specifically their aerospace force. So they are the ones who controlled the ballistic missiles. They've used them in other places such as Syria and Iraq. In fact, they used them in a deadly strike against Kurdish forces in 2018. And you could think of them as sort of Iran's air force. Iran has sanctions, so it's actually quite hard for them to keep planes in the air. But they can produce these missiles indigenously, and they can use them with great effect to strike targets at a distance.
Is this part of a large arsenal? I mean, how many other types of weapons does Iran have at its disposal?
Iran has quite a few other types of weapons. It has suicide drones. It has cruise missiles. Those were both used in an attack against a Saudi oil facility last year. It has anti-ship missiles. It has air defense missiles that it used to shoot down the U.S. drone. I believe that was last year as well. I mean, this is important to understand. This is not, you know, a militia. This is a military, and they have a number of relatively sophisticated systems like this that they can use in different ways.
Can the U.S. do anything to stop attacks like these that we saw here?
It's pretty hard to do. I mean, these are ballistic missiles. As I said, they come in really fast, and they also are difficult to intercept. Now, you can try to strike them before they launch, but Iran tends to disguise its missile trucks as civilian vehicles. They've reportedly dispersed those trucks already from their bases, so you'd have to go into Iran to try and find them. And if you did that, you'd be up against their air defenses. So the U.S. may not have a lot of good options for stopping these kinds of attacks.
A lot of information there from NPR's Jeff Brumfield. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes. For more insight now on the situation between the U.S. and Iran and what might come next, we're joined by former U.S. Ambassador Nicholas Burns, professor at the Harvard Kennedy School. He joins us by Skype. Good morning, Ambassador, and thanks for speaking to WBUR's Morning Edition.
Good morning, Bob.
So based on what we've learned about the Iranian retaliation so far, do you expect Iran to take further action? And what do you think the U.S. military response, if any, might be?
Well, it does not appear that Iran is going to retaliate further. This appears to be designed as a single act of retaliation. The Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, essentially said so. He said, "We don't seek escalation," those were his words, "or war, but we'll defend ourselves against any further aggression." Iran knows that the United States is far stronger militarily. They don't want to risk this authoritarian regime a wider war with the U.S., but I think the Iranians felt they had to strike back. Now I think it's up to President Trump to decide what to do. He's going to address the nation. It's always difficult to know what President Trump will do in a situation like this, but I think it's likely he'll at least be advised by the military and the State Department not to respond further. The president can say that that the United States took decisive action in killing General Soleimani. The president will certainly criticize, as he should, the Iranian attacks last evening in Iraq and in American forces. Fortunately, there were no casualties. He can warn Iran of further retaliation, but it doesn't make a lot of sense for the United States to retaliate further. That risks a wider war, and that's not in the U.S. interest.
We should point out that the president is expected to address the nation sometime after 9 o'clock this morning, and WBUR will have live coverage. All he's said so far in a tweet is "all is well." So let me ask you this. What do you think U.S. diplomats are likely doing right now to prevent escalation?
Well, I think the key thing here is really to convince the president to give the American people and the Congress a very specific sense of what the plan is. What is the president trying to achieve with the attack, the assassination of General Soleimani, and whether we should respond now? And I think the essential set of choices is this. Are we trying to contain Iran, or are we trying to defeat Iran in a wider war? I think the majority of American military and diplomatic leaders want to follow a policy of containing Iran. Iran is a threat to the United States. It did attack American forces. It also attacked our embassy, Iranian proxies, just at the end of December. And so I think containing Iran makes sense. That's been the policy for many decades. A wider war is not in the interest of the United States because we would risk, of course, a tremendous number of casualties. We'd risk our position in the Middle East. We do not have a lot of support right now from our European allies. Our Arab partners have been silent throughout this conflict. They've not been demonstrably supportive of the U.S. I think that's the best choice for the president. I hope he makes it this morning.
A lot of people are looking at the White House wondering what it's going to do next. Do you think that the White House, this administration, has laid out anything close to a strategy or a clear strategy as to what it intends to do about Iran beyond the assassination of Soleimani?
I don't think the president has done that. I think he needs to do that now. In a situation like this, if you think back to all of our former presidents, they would spell out for the American people, what are our interests in Iraq right now, and in Iran as well, and in Syria, in the wider Middle East? What are we trying to accomplish, and how do we do that? The president has done nothing like that. We've had a series of tweets. They've been circumspect. They've been hard to decipher. And he needs to speak clearly this morning because, frankly, the Congress is going to demand an explanation like that. There'll be congressional hearings. We are a democracy. The American people deserve to know what their government is doing. And we need to establish clarity about what the United States is trying to do. Our larger interests would point towards the United States focusing first and foremost on the threats from China and Russia, not from the Middle East. And so it makes sense for the president to stop where he is right now if the Iranians don't intend to respond further.
Former U.S. Ambassador Nicholas Burns, professor at the Harvard Kennedy School, thanks very much for speaking to WBUR this morning.
Thanks very much, Bob.
Just ahead on Morning Edition, the scene in recent days at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where the 82nd Airborne is headquartered and deploys from, as it's now done, again. Forecast, we get sunshine. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
We'll see the sunshine return later on this morning and early afternoon, 35 to 40 with a gusty westerly wind. For tonight, the winds continue. It's cold. We're down in the teens. Wind chills by morning will be in the single numbers. On Thursday, sunshine, only 25 to 30, less wind. Friday, we're back to the mid to upper 40s. The winds flip around to the southwest this time. And Saturday, the real story is the mild air, low to mid 60s, a couple of showers around the area. Sunday, a few more showers, maybe a thunderstorm. Temperatures in the 50s, falling late in the day.
In Boston now, 32 degrees. Subscribe to the WBUR Today newsletter to get Dave's forecast every weekday in your inbox. Now, Bostonomics Business, the Cambridge-based education firm edX, is out with a program billed as a low-cost, fast-track way to a bachelor's degree. Its micro-bachelor's program gives access to thousands of online courses from more than 100 top schools, including MIT and Harvard. edX's CEO is Adam Medros.
It certainly, from a price standpoint, is the most affordable path to getting a full bachelor's degree. But the bigger advantage is the ability to build skills right now that are relevant for the job you have, for the career development you're looking for, while fitting this into your day-to-day life.
He says the program provides workers with immediately transferable skills that are delivered in months, not years. This is WBUR. It's 8:45.
We are funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Standard Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling. Owned and operated in Dorchester, Boston Standard is an independent train comfort specialist dealer. BostonStandardPlumbing.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. This is an uncertain time for members of the U.S. military community and their families. As tensions between the United States and Iran escalate, the Pentagon has deployed part of the 82nd Airborne Division to Kuwait. That division is based in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and that is where we find Jay Price from member station WUNC.
Across the country, thousands of cell phones rang, interrupting holiday season vacations, household chores, and private family moments. Rachel Hertel's husband, Alex, got one of those calls.
And we thought that it was a drill, because that happens. You know, you got 2 hours, you need to come in.
But this wasn't practice. This was real. They and their four kids were in Ohio, visiting her terminally ill mother. They packed the kids in the car and started driving back. The 82nd Airborne is often referred to as the nation's 911 force. One of the division's three brigades of about 4,000 soldiers has to be ready to fly to a crisis area anywhere in the world in just hours. Sergeant Hertel had gotten special permission to travel because of his mother-in-law's health issues. Rachel Hertel said the drive back was tense. Telling their kids their father was deploying wasn't easy. Three are foster children, which made it even harder.
My biological child, Joshua, he's almost nine, and this is his third deployment. But for our other children, this is their first time being military children. And then to finally bond with a father that they love, who they're hoping will adopt them.
Kat Bartlett, whose family owns the paratrooper-themed Morning Jump coffee shop, says surges of troops leaving and returning are part of the rhythm of life here.
I'm hearing that a lot of them are deploying. A lot of them are on call to deploy. A lot are gone. Some are coming in and they're saying, this is my last coffee, so wish me luck.
Around this base, there are few visible clues anything's out of the ordinary, other than hours-long traffic jams at the main gates because of heightened security checks. But the formal and informal support networks for the families have sprung to life, like Jill Jaragowski's neighbors, who quickly noticed her husband's truck was gone and called to check in, and her friends, who are always ready to help.
Sometimes they'll order pizza and tell me, hey, dinner's coming, don't worry about it tonight, which is awesome. They've been known to leave cocktails on the front door or front step, which is very much appreciated. especially at the end of the day.
Jerigowski is a seasoned veteran of deployments, but it can still be tough. And this time, no one knows when the soldiers will be back.
Not having a date or a time frame to like look forward to, or just, you know, the end goal, like, okay, we're almost there, we're halfway there. Like, I have no idea. I can't, you know, the kids don't know, like, will daddy be here for my birthday? You know, I have no idea.
Rachel Hurdle says that could mean missing important family moments, like a family formally becoming a family.
I am just holding on to hope that he'll be home and we will have one big, huge adoption party with daddy there. But if not, I do have a specific power of attorney and his blessing that I can sign that paperwork and we'll celebrate when he gets home. But it just won't quite be the same. That's military life. Babies are born, adoptions happen, emergency situations take place, and they're not always here.
And it's not always clear when they'll be back. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price at Fort Bragg.
Things are getting smarter. Phones, speakers, bathroom sinks. What does it mean when your stuff seems to know what you want before you do? NPR's technology correspondent Shannon Bond went to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas to find out.
CES is filled with some of the most familiar names in technology. Google, Amazon, Samsung, Weber grills.
The Weber Connect platform can turn any grill into a smart grill, and so it gives you a step-by-step grilling experience to make sure that you get the very best food on the back end.
Chris Scherzinger is CEO of Weber. For the company's CES debut, he's come prepared to talk the technology talk. Platform, smart grill. He shows me what he means at Weber's outdoor barbecue here in Las Vegas. There's hardware, a big black grill with a small display on one side.
That screen will tell you the temperature of the grill itself. It'll tell you the temperature of each probe that you're using. So in this case, there's a probe going into this brisket, and you'd read that on the screen.
It's lunchtime, and the air is filled with the smoky smells of brisket and chicken being grilled for tacos. The smart grill syncs up to Weber's new smartphone app, Weber Connect. You open the app and pick the meat you want to cook. The app tells you the right seasoning, when to flip it, when it's done. A lot of the companies that showed up at CES this year make products that are hardly known for technology. Grills, toilets, mattresses. So why does every product today need to be smart or connected? Some people here at CES tell me it's about using technology to free ourselves from technology.
80% of consumers bring a phone into the bathroom. We're trying to reverse that a little.
Jonathan Bradley is a product manager at Kohler, which makes bathroom fixtures.
We want the bathroom to stay a place of rest, relaxation, calm, and recharging, and only have technology when you actually need it.
At CES, the company is showing off its new shower head, Moxie. It has a removable waterproof speaker right in the middle where the water comes out. You operate it through Amazon's Alexa voice assistant or your phone's Bluetooth connection. Moxie joins other techified fixtures in Kohler's Connect line. There's a mirror you can ask to brighten or lower the light or play your favorite radio station. The mirror can even tell the shower to turn on and off, at least when the Wi-Fi at CES cooperates.
Alexa, ask Connect to start my shower.
Sorry, something went wrong. Please try again.
Oh, there we go.
Can I try turning it off?
Yeah.
Alexa, ask Connect to stop my shower.
Turning off shower.
Kohler is not the only company I run into that thinks technology can save us from our bad tech habits. At another booth, there's a line to try out Muse. It's a headband that gives voice-guided meditations. The sounds you hear change depending on your brain activity, heart rate, and breathing. Co-founder Arielle Garten says using her product to meditate has given her some distance from her smartphone.
I can sit with a little bit of discomfort of wanting to check my phone and say, nope, it's okay, move my mind away onto something that matters to me. So it's a little bit ironic that we're using technology to disconnect from technology, but it really works.
It sounds tempting, but the line is long, and other gadgets beckon. Shannon Bond, NPR News, Las Vegas.
Hi, Ira Flatow from Science Friday here. Join folks from Sci-Fry Thursday, January 16th at WBUR City Space for the Create Curiosity Fair. Art and science collide at a science fair you won't soon forget. So bring the whole family. Anyone under 12 can come for free. Details at wbur.org/cityspace.
Ahead on WBUR's Morning Edition, his plans for housing, transportation, and education outlined in Boston Mayor Marty Walsh's State of the City address last night. Forecast turning sunny today where it's not already, upper 30s today, clear and cold tonight down to the teens, sunny tomorrow and Friday, it'll only be in the 20s tomorrow, in the 40s on Friday, could be showers Saturday and Sunday, but 60 on Saturday and in the 50s on Sunday. In Boston now, 32 degrees, it's 8:54.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Fidelity Investments, reminding you it's never too early to start saving for your child's future. Learn more about a tax-advantaged 529 college savings account at fidelity.com/ufund. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE SIPC.
This is WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is vowing to expand efforts to address the city's affordable housing shortage. In his annual State of the City address last night, Walsh presented plans to raise $500 million over 5 years to support affordable housing. He also pledged to do more to address transportation problems and increase equity in the school system. WBUR's Simone Rios was at the speech and has this report.
We believe in our young people. We believe in our working people. We believe in our elders. We believe in our veterans and first responders.
Speaking at Symphony Hall, the mayor took stock of high notes, continued economic strength of the city, a reduction in crime, and signs of a stabilizing housing market. But Walsh also addressed longstanding struggles for the city. He called the Boston Public Schools a tale of two districts.
We are graduating an incredible number of talented, diverse, ambitious young people all across the city. But too much potential is still being lost for the students who face the toughest challenges. What we do, what it takes to be one great district. Every single student in every single neighborhood, in every single school.
Walsh touted investments in universal pre-kindergarten, longer school days, English language learning, special education, and $100 million in new funding aimed first at underperforming schools. The mayor zeroed in on transportation as a major problem that needs fixing. He expressed frustration with the state legislature. He said it's failed to fix the region's transportation woes. And he said lawmakers need to allow Boston to raise its own revenue to invest in transportation and other initiatives.
Other states have enabled cities as different as Los Angeles, Indianapolis, and Phoenix to use regional ballot initiatives to take a quantum leap forward in transportation. People voted for the projects and the revenue to fund them. Now they're being built.
The third pillar of Walsh's State of the City was housing. He said the city's current housing policy is working, and there are signs that rents and home prices are beginning to stabilize.
But they're still too high for too many people. There's much more work to be done. So tonight, I'm announcing an unprecedented investment, $500 million over 5 years to create thousands of homes all across our city, affordable to a range of incomes from our most vulnerable to the middle class.
That drew some of the biggest applause of the night. But the legislature needs to allow the city to raise the revenue if Walsh is going to be able to make good on his promise. Housing advocate Joe Kreisberg.
The mayor is showing real leadership, and we need the state legislature and the governor to also show leadership and pass the city's home rule petition to allow it to strengthen its own linkage and inclusionary development programs, allow it to establish a transfer tax to fund affordable housing. We need to make sure the city of Boston has the tools it needs to serve its own citizens and its own residents.
Not everyone agrees with the mayor's take on the state of the city. City Councilor Andrea Campbell says there needs to be more substance behind Walsh's big spending pledges.
It's not just about making an announcement that says you're going to invest millions of dollars. It requires a plan and a vision. If you are going to eliminate inequities in the Boston public schools, ensure that all of our families truly have access to a high-quality school, you have to do more than to make an announcement at the State of the City or throw more money at the problem.
Joining Campbell on the council this year is Liz Breeden. She says the mayor's housing vision resonates with her, but she wants to see more progress in her district.
Many of the issues that we're working on in the neighborhood, he's addressed. My concern is that out in Alston Brighton, which is the district I represent, We're building a lot of housing, but very, very, very little of it is affordable in the district.
Breeden says she's looking forward to working with the mayor to make sure he's able to fulfill his pledge to raise $500 million for housing over the next half decade. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Simon Rios.
Now another look at the weather. Turning sunny today, it'll be breezy and in the upper 30s. Tonight just plain cold, clear skies, lows down to the teens, but the wind chills will make it feel like it's in the single digits tonight. Tomorrow not much warmer, sunny in the 20s. Friday partly sunny in the 40s. The weekend will be warmer, cloudy on Saturday, could be some showers. It'll be around 60 on Saturday. Sunday showers in the 50s. In Boston now, 32 degrees.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up today on Point, a continent in flames. Bushfires so hot they're creating their own thunderstorms. We'll take a close look at Australia's catastrophic fires and the lessons for the world. Plus, 20% of confirmed pregnancies end in miscarriage in the first trimester. More women are talking about it to destigmatize the loss. That's On Point this morning from 10 to noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston.
92.7 WBUA Tisbury.
89.1 WBUH Brewster.
Streaming at WBUR.org.
And live at CitySpace, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.